the center of it all in the L.A. studios during what was undoubtedly rock's apex. Both were also stars in their own right, even if much of the public never had any awareness. Perhaps you've heard of them. If not, just check out the liner notes and credits inside and or on the backs of dozens of your old classic rock album covers. You'll be in for a surprise. Though the hits have long since dried up, many, if not most, of the same album rock artists from those days are still around, appearing nightly before thousands. Though I wish them well in their current endeavors, mostly I am unendingly glad to have been there the first time around, to have experienced the pleasure of their music as it was originally happening. And I'm equally happy now to share the massive number of stories I've culled from those very musicians and producers. If I could somehow beam myself back, I probably would. It really was that cool. But until the technology of time travel catches up with my dreams, permit me the joy of showing you within Goodnight LA what it was all like. 1. Talk, talk. Get the hell off my stage. Janis Joplin. When Charles Manson squeezed off the first round from his .38 automatic inside the Sound City recording studio in Van Nuys, California, no one knew what to do. But one bullet was all it took. Before the future serial killer could even think about firing a second shot, everyone in the place dove for cover. It was early 1969, over 6 months before the grisly Tate LaBianca murders for which Manson and his family would forever be associated, when the diminutive ex-con was simply known to most as Charlie. A lifelong petty thief, Manson had migrated to California during the mid-60s, in part to try his hand at a career in music. As a self-taught singer-songwriter with an acoustic guitar ever at the ready, Manson had written a number of songs by the time he hooked up with the Beach Boys' co-founder and drummer, Dennis Wilson. Wilson, a ruggedly handsome, naive, fun-loving character with an eye for the ladies, and they for him, came across a couple of Manson's female followers one day as they hitchhiked along the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu. After giving Patricia Krenwinkel and Ella Jo Bailey a ride back to his palatial home on Sunset Boulevard, the young women quickly dropped their clothes and made themselves available to Wilson in any way he wanted, an opportunity the free-spirited musician could not resist. From there, the girls invited their beloved Charlie, along with a busload of his other followers, to move right on in with them. And for a time, it seemed like one big party to Wilson. He had sex with any and all of the girls whenever he pleased, no questions asked, and no condoms required. It was his own private Gomorrah. But after Wilson talked to his friend, the record producer Terry Melcher, and Doris Day's son, into giving Manson a tryout in the studio, things went downhill in a hurry. Melcher disliked Manson's singing even more than he disliked his personality and declined to offer him a recording contract. In turn, an infuriated Manson came down hard on Wilson, demanding that he make good on his alleged promise to help him become a star. Not knowing what else to do, and growing more fearful by the day in the face of Manson's increasingly menacing ways, Wilson finally told Manson he would pay for him to cut some songs at Sound City in Van Nuys, out in the San Fernando Valley, which was a new studio Wilson had heard about that apparently wasn't too expensive. Which all went as planned until afterward, when Wilson neglected to pay the bill for the recording time. Accordingly, the studio chose to hold on to Manson's master tapes until the money appeared, as per industry custom. And that's when the gunplay began. "Give me my fucking tapes!" a wild-eyed Manson snarled, waving his Smith & Wesson as he stepped inside the studio's front door. The petrified sound engineer and receptionist on duty that day didn't have to be asked twice. Manson got his tapes, and Sound City ended up with a nice bullet hole in a metal cabinet for its trouble, which on many levels was the perfect metaphor for the rapidly changing American music business itself in the 60s. By mid-1969, the simple, happy-go-lucky world of 45 RPM singles and top 40 AM radio in America was beginning a slow, inexorable decline toward irrelevancy. Once the twin titans of delivering hit songs to the public, 45s and AM were gradually being supplanted in popularity by vinyl LPs and the newly created underground freeform radio.